All right, Pablo, we're back in data world. Tell people who you are. What do you do, man?
Hey, I'm Pablo. I work on the data programmability team at Microsoft. Uh-huh. This is part of the database group, the SQL Server group.
Yep.
Within that, I'm the tech lead for ADL.NET and some other data access technologies in general. Like, this is the group that looks at how sort of how developers work with data in their applications, how we enable scenarios in different spaces to work with data in your applications.
Sure. And last time we talked to you, we were talking about the entity data model.
Yep.
Entity framework.
Yes.
And today, there apparently you cooked up something else. What is this?
So the entity framework is going really well. We got a lot of feedback from the developer community. So we're taking the feedback, we're incorporating a lot of it. So we're really, really happy with how the entity framework in general is going.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the next question comes, which is, okay, we have the entity framework. That is a middle tier technology. It works great when you're coding directly to the API, and the runtime has line of sight with the database, which is great for enterprise scenario, you know, 2 and 3 tier applications and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question that we're asking is, what does it mean for the web? Like, how, like, if now you're not in a closed environment, you're in an open environment and you're building applications in the web, how do you deal with data? How do you operate with data in that environment?
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of the original question. And from that, we took the entity framework and other building blocks in the Windows Communication Foundation infrastructure for talking between clients and servers.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the entity framework to talk to the database and do mapping, and a few other technologies. And we said, okay, what it means to have an experience in the web for data access that is naturally integrated into the web, rather than sort of rolling something completely new that, you know, requires new infrastructure and new components across the system. So, to give some context on this, let me do some whiteboarding.
Please.
So I can give you.
Whiteboarding is good.
So, if you look at how, like, a typical application would have been built, like, shortly ago, basically what you have is, you have, like, the web. You have to do, like, a cloud for this, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have your web server, mm-hmm. and you have your client, like, your desktop computer, right? So, whenever the web server sends content to a client, you go HTTP something and you know, say, connect to a web application. What this guy typically used to do is, you will run an ASP.NET piece of code or a PHP piece of code or whatever, and this guy will do some rendering of the presentation information of the page, like, you know, the text elements, all the visuals, you will get some pictures here,
mm-hmm.
and then it will connect to a database system, pull the data and render it inline,
mm-hmm.
and then send the whole page back to the client.
Yes.
So by the time this makes it to the client, like, there's all together. There is code and there is behaviors. There is sort of the visual aspect of the page, and the data is embedded within the page itself.
Mm-hmm.
And this worked, you know, fine. And we have solid support for this kind of application architecture today in the .NET framework.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a shift in the way this is happening now. If you look at applications like Ajax-based applications, or also applications built around Silverlight or Flash, where you have a rich client,
mm-hmm.
Or a rich client experience, mm-hmm. what happens is data and presentation information are not traveling together anymore. Like, let's look at the Ajax example. In Ajax, what happens is, typically, I mean, there is no fixed pattern for this, but in general, what happens is you connect to some web page in your web application, and the page contains all of the visuals, and it contains some code, it has references to JavaScript code.
Mm-hmm.
The page goes down to the client, maybe with some initial information, but in general, it just goes with behavior and presentation information.
Sure.
Now, the client application then connects back to the server system to some application code that does the actual access to the database.
Yeah.
And this interaction, going back and forth, which is typically done using JavaScript and using the XML HTTP request object on the browser,
yep.
is pure data. There's no presentation information here. The presentation information is all in the client, and as you interact with the application, is that you get all of the pure data going back and forth between the client and the server.
Absolutely.
This is very common in Ajax, as an Ajax pattern,
mm-hmm.
and it also so happens that in scenarios like Silverlight, where you pre-build your application and it's delivered as a DLL to the client,
mm-hmm.
so there is not even the option to actually embed the data and the code all together and ship it in a single shot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the code will always download separately, and now you need a model to go fetch data,
mm-hmm.
right? So sort of the problem statement, if you will, that this sort of lands on is there is the need for tackling sort of this space, which is there is a need for how do we deal with data interfaces on the web, right? Mm-hmm. This is pure data. We know how to serve content and how to serve behavior in the form of JavaScript files or Silverlight DLLs or Flash packages. But the question is, now how do we interact with data?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can roll your own. And for this small case, this is not a big challenge. You can run your own PHP script or ASP.NET handler and send XML or something between the client and the server.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with rolling your own is, well, first, you have to do it and maintain it later on. But also, by rolling your own, it's like since everybody will roll a different interface to this thing, it's very hard to sort of reuse and leverage patterns so then other pieces can be built on top. So this is where the thing we've been building comes in.
Okay.
We've been working on this project. The code name of the project is Astoria.
Hmm.
And what Astoria aims to do is, what we want to do is tackle this space in a way that is super straightforward to create a data service and to expose that data service to applications or as part of the applications. So then the client components that are running across the internet on the other side of the web can trivially come back to a server and interact with the data store that you're using to store information.
Hmm.
There are a couple of sort of key aspects to Astoria.
Yeah.
First of all, this is so the entire system is very, very HTTP friendly. Like one of the sort of core tenets of this is we don't want to invent anything new. We want to leverage as much of the infrastructure of the web as is possible.
Okay.
So the way you interact with Astoria stores is first you locate information using just URIs. So usually you have like an entry point to your data service.
Okay.
So let's say you have like a customer's store, so you have, customers. We usually take an SVC extension, and this is like an HTTP something, so it will be HTTP colon something, and then eventually you will get to this. And you could say things like slash customers.
Okay.
And this simply means give me all the customers you've got in your store.
Hmm.
And again, it's very simple, very HTTP format. You can also, like, very typically, you will never want the, all of the customers. So
sure.
You could say things like, 1, 2, 3 or something, where this guy is the key, the key to this particular customer.
Mm-hmm.
And this means go fetch this customer from the store. And the definition of customer actually comes from the entity data model, where we know what a customer is.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say customer sub something and you give us a key, we know where to go find the customer. We know what the primary keys for that guy are. So
mm-hmm.
we know how to go to the database and fetch that particular customer.
Interesting.
So this is just a regular HTTP URI. What you do is you send an HTTP GET request to the
mm-hmm.
server. And what you get back is, by default, you get a very simple XML encoding of the entity.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the case of the customer, you will get the name and the address
sure.
or whatever. And you can also change headers. So instead of XML, you can also get JSON payload, which is the JavaScript object notation, which is very nice for Ajax-based applications because it's you can just eval the answer. It's JavaScript. So when you eval, you get a nice object tree back in the client or an object graph back in the client.
Nice.
So it's a very nice model for interacting with data without having to write almost any code in the client.
You have to write code in the client to interact with the blob that you get back.
Absolutely. Then you have to write the rendering code.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah,
you have to parse the XML, right?
Well, if you do XML, yes, you have to use some infrastructure
sure.
to parse it. Now, if you use JSON, the nice thing about JSON is that it's just JavaScript. So you don't need to parse it. You just call eval, which is a built-in function
sure.
in JavaScript, and what you get back is objects. Of course, now you have to write the code to render something in the UI or
absolutely.
React to the data. But there is very little code to actually interact with the store. Like if you use like most of the Ajax libraries that are out there today, like
mm-hmm.
The Microsoft ASP.NET Ajax or the Dojo library and all those have built-in functions to go do HTTP requests that make it super easy to interact with the store in a way like this.
Outstanding. So let's go over this again real quickly
okay.
though, because this is totally brand new to me at least.
So.
If the data store already exists, and I have to run some tool over it to enable
yes.
this?
Yes, you have a database already there. You run it. You are in Visual Studio.
Mm-hmm.
You have a regular ASP.NET project. What
yeah.
you do is you add a new item. There is a new item template called Web Data Service. You just run that guy. What you get back is a data service. By default, we expose everything. There are policies, so you cannot expose nothing, anything at all for by default, mm-hmm. or you can tweak which shows or not. And in the first instance, that's it. You hit the five, now you have a data service. Then you get, there's a lot of customization you can do to the data service,
okay.
but the critical path is designed so that it is very, very straightforward. Once you're done with that, your site will have a .svc file, and that .svc file is the root of your store.
Nice.
So then each one of the tables, by default, we map them to one slash something, so slash customers or slash orders and so on. We let you fetch individual entities by putting keys in brackets.
Nice.
The other thing that is that when you do HTTP GET, you retrieve an entity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we support all of the operations, so you can do HTTP put and actually put an entity on the server, literally doing an update all the way down to the database. And you can also do HTTP delete to delete an entity and so on.
Now,
so,
just to ask a question, mm-hmm. though, does the URI support calling a stored procedure?
That's a good question. So we don't want to expose the database directly. So what we do is, by default, we expose an EDM view of the database that is the default generated one-to-one from the database. So you can do two things with that. One is you can adapt the shape using the mapping infrastructure, which is just a declarative XML file that says how things relate between the storage model and the sort of the visible model that surfaces in the URI space.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can also add methods to the data service on the server side that you can call using the URI syntax. Those methods internally can build custom queries, or they can call store procedures or do other things.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing is the invocation pattern is still very similar. Like, for example,
mm-hmm.
You could do something like having slash customers by city, for example. And then you go question mark city equals, you know, something Seattle.
Typical pattern, then an ampersand if you have to add more.
An ampersand if you have to add more.
Really
so
cool.
This is very, very simple on purpose. We didn't want to invent any new encoding or anything. This just leverages regular HTTP requests.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about this is HTTP, which means it will go over proxies. It will use regular HTTP authentication.
Mm-hmm.
The server side of Astoria integrates with ASP.NET authentication. So if you are already authenticated, you leverage that for authorization. Proxies work, even HTTP caching works, which
Excellent.
Means, like, if you do want to do distributed data caching, the problem has been already solved for HTTP, and we're just leveraging that. So
Excellent.
The fact that we are sort of just naturally integrated into HTTP helps a lot with being a good sort of web citizen, if you will.
Absolutely.
Another interesting aspect is that the patterns are very uniform in the URI format, regardless of what is the store that is, or what is the actual schema. Like, you could have a customer database that has customers and sales orders, or you could have, a social bookmarking site that has, you know, tags and users or whatever. It's any schema you want.
Mm-hmm.
The URIs follow the same pattern always. There is always a way of drilling into each one of the containers. We call them entity sets, which look like tables.
Mm-hmm.
There is always the same way of doing filtering using the bracket syntax. There's also a way, like after the question mark, you can request sorting or paging, give me the third page or fourth page or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that is uniform regardless of the actual schema, which means now you can build libraries on the client or control, like UI controls or widgets
mm-hmm.
that you can, for example, all you would specify is you are going to work with slash customers.
Mm-hmm.
And now the UI widget will know how to do paging over that set, how to locate a particular one, even how to do resorting by clicking on the columns, all
mm-hmm.
without you coding anything, because that's sort of a uniform pattern for any URI that is an Astoria URI. So it's like the added semantics on the URI, while they don't sort of diverge from the format of the URI,
mm-hmm.
lets you leverage sort of the knowledge of being an Astoria service on the other end by controls and things like that.
So now Astoria then is implemented as what? Not an ISAPI DLL, but what is it?
Astoria is like, strictly speaking, is an a Windows Communication Foundation extension.
Nice.
So you can see a broader pattern there where the Windows Communication Foundation team is working on what it means in general to have programmability support over HTTP, how to expose on the server end HTTP endpoints,
mm-hmm.
REST endpoints, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and also on the client, how to consume them. And those are very general purpose. You can do anything on the input, anything on the output. There is no pattern, and it's very powerful because it's very general.
Mm-hmm.
So data services are specialization of WCF services that are aware of the data they are backing. So when you create a regular Indigo service, you also get a .svc file. It's the same infrastructure, but you can write methods to do pretty much anything you want. Mm. When you create an Astoria service, you get a special form of WCF service that specifically knows all of these characteristics of the data that it's supporting. So you get all of this URI syntax, all the filtering, and all of these services just for free without having to do anything. But the alignment is very, so it's very natural. In fact, you can mix like regular WCF methods, which are called service operations, with Astoria services. So you get, if you have almost all of it being data backed by a data service, but there's this one thing that you need a custom behavior for, you can still add it to the data service and it looks like a method call.
Outstanding.
So it's a very sort of very nice end-to-end integration.
So I guess the other part of the question, the reason I mentioned ISAPI was because clearly IIS is involved here.
Yes.
You're calling a URL, so it needs to know when it sees this that this actually means do something interesting.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And so some way you have to tell IIS to handle these requests.
Exactly, exactly. We do this, strictly speaking, we do this on the ASP.NET side of things, not in the IIS side of things, which mm-hmm. in IIS 7, the difference is not quite clear because IIS 7 is very flexible and it can run manage handlers and modules anywhere in the pipeline.
Certainly.
But for previous versions, this is a more traditional sort of extension to ASP.NET,
mm-hmm.
And it works like so. Since it is an Indigo service or a WCF service, it works.
Indigo is a much cooler name.
Yeah, it's going to take me some years to get rid of it. That means that so today we only support hosting in ASP.NET, but eventually once we're done with this work, this is just the first CTP.
Mm-hmm.
This will work anywhere where you can host an Indigo service.
Okay.
It's just a specialization of it, which also gives you the sort of the freedom of choosing the sort of the hosting model. Mm. For web scenarios, typically you will still use an ASP.NET server because that's what ISPs have. That's what typically you have in your web data centers and so on.
Absolutely.
So you probably still use that. But there is some flexibility there that you can use.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
So this was a quick overview.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few. So it's a tooling experience we're building around this.
Okay.
So we have item templates to create the data services on the server side. And then on the client side, we also are building some libraries. We're working with the ASP.NET team so that the Ajax toolkit understands these URIs and these formats and so on. That's for the Ajax side. And then for the Silverlight side, we're looking at building a managed library. So if you're coding in C# or Visual Basic inside Silverlight,
mm-hmm.
you get a very nice, strongly typed API that hits the data services over HTTP.
Beautiful.
So you're still going over HTTP, very high level, very sort of well integrated with the web, but it is a nice experience.
Absolutely.
And finally, the next thing we're doing is we're doing an interesting experiment with this as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this, the deal here is you download the bits that are out there in astoria.mslivelabs.com, and that you use them in your own deployment. That's one option. The other option is we're actually going to experimentally host these bits in one part of live.com.
Mm-hmm.
What this means is you're going to be able to go to live.com and either consume data services that are living right out up there in the web,
mm-hmm.
or a little bit later on, create your own. So what this means is first, In the first round, which is going to happen any time now, what's going to happen is you can connect over the web to to Astoria. The URL is something like astoria.mslivelabs.com.
Okay.
Good luck with my handwriting.
We can put that in the post.
That's perfect. And so then here, what you have is like URLs with this format.
Mm-hmm.
For pre-created examples. So we are hosting the Northwind database, which is like a well-known example.
Mm-hmm.
We are also hosting the Encarta team. Let us borrow a subset of their article base.
Nice.
So we actually have a structured version of the Encarta encyclopedia articles.
Nice.
So you can browse the categories, you can ask questions like, give me all of the articles that talk about geography or things like that, and it still is a data interface, so you can build your own the face for it any way you want.
Absolutely.
We also have Tilespace. Tilespace is a social bookmarking infrastructure that we have off of MSDN.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have the type part of that database, the part that doesn't have any user information, up there, so you can browse the tags, how they relate to links, and you can explore that, and it's pure data. You can use HTTP to fetch that and use any client.
Excellent.
To actually interact with this thing. So,
and of course, these are read-only.
And of course, these are read-only. That's a good point. Otherwise, it would be pretty messy.
Yeah.
But what we're doing is we're working. This will come a little bit later, but only weeks. Mm. What we're doing is we are working on letting you create your own store up in the cloud.
Nice.
So what you're going to be able to do, and this is, again, an experiment. We'll see how it goes. Is you go to astoria.mslivelabs.com. You sign in with your account,
mm-hmm.
create your account. You describe the shape of your schema using a very simple web-based UI,
mm-hmm.
and then click create, and we give you a URI that is your store in the cloud. Now you
nice.
Can hit that from your Windows Vista widgets or gadgets. You can build your own maybe desktop application that connects over HTTP to the web, or use it from any other way. You can build a mashup that sort of uses this as one of the data sources,
mm-hmm.
and these data sources, all of the other data sources are read-only, typically, because they are RSS feeds.
Absolutely.
Whereas these guys read-write. So this is a way of building mashups that actually maintain state.
Now let me ask you this. I mean,
yeah.
That's an incredible idea,
mm-hmm.
the notion of data in the cloud,
because uh-huh.
That's something that's typically missing. You always have
yep.
to build your database, ship
yep.
your database
yep.
off, put it up on its own server, then have someone that knows how to handle it.
Yeah.
So I think it's a brilliant idea to enable that in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you restrict usage?
That's a very good question. So I'll give you a two-step answer.
Uh-huh.
So again, as I said before, this is an experimental release.
Understood.
That
it's a good experiment.
So the nice thing about experiments is that you can say the SLA or the service level agreement for this is there is no SLA. So
okay.
It's a best effort deal.
Uh-huh.
So right now, what we're going to do is we're going to put a cap on how much size you can have on a given one store.
Mm-hmm.
We'll probably shoot for 100 megs or something like that. Like, we don't want to go too big. This is still structured or semi-structured data.
Mm-hmm.
So 100 megs typically works pretty well. And none of these, for example, is over 100 megs.
Okay.
The whole service is run on a best effort basis. And the goal of this effort is actually to explore all of this space. We want to learn whether the programmability or the programming interface actually works well, whether the interaction models are good, whether the scenarios that we're envisioning are actually viable on the web. And once we learn about all this and hear all of the feedback from the web developer community, then we'll start looking into how this becomes a more concrete product and how do we tackle challenges like how do you manage the storage size, how do you throttle bandwidth, or if you don't throttle bandwidth, then what do you do with to control the usage of the service?
Absolutely.
So we still have some ways to go there,
uh-huh.
But we wanted to take a very sort of open approach, and this is super, super early for all of this technology.
Absolutely.
But we chose to say, let's go just out to the web, let's roll it out and get some feedback early on so we can react to this on time for actually incorporating all of the feedback that we can back into the product.
Fantastic, man.
Mm-hmm.
This is very cool stuff. So do you want to show a little demo? Or?
Okay, let's do a quick thing. I'm not going to do a lot of coding because it's not fun to look at the screen and do someone else do coding, but let's see. So what I want to show is very, very quickly, I already have a pre-created data service,
mm-hmm.
so I'm going to show what it looks like to consume that data service. And
you're running Vista, which is nice.
I'm running Vista, yes. I kind of work in Microsoft, this whole deal. So first, I'm going to hit the data service just using the browser.
Okay.
So you can see what it looks like, the payloads that come back. Okay, and make this a little bit bigger. So if I hit the root of the website of the data service, what I get is the list of all of the containers that are available in this particular location.
Nice.
And now I can drill down. I can say slash customers, for example, and I have to spell it right.
Yeah.
And I get all of the customers in this case in the database.
Nice.
And I can restrict to a particular customer if I know the key. And the interesting part is, you can see that each one of the customers have a set of primitive values,
mm-hmm.
but it also has a URI that says where this particular entity lives. And this feels like a resource in URI terms.
Hmm.
So I can take this guy, put it here, and I have to spell it right too. And what I get is this particular entity down to the client.
Nice.
I can also, here, you can see that all of these are scalar properties. Mm-hmm. But this guy here is like in the data model, in the description of the schema, we are the when we configure this, it says that every customer is related to a set of orders through an association. So this here surfaces as a basically as an href, as an indirection to another resource. Let me make this bigger. So what it says here is, if you want to learn about the orders for this customer, go to this URI here. So I'm going to go here and say /orders. And what this means is this is a URI that points to all of the orders for a particular customer. Mm. So it's very high level, very easy way, very natural way of integrating URIs to navigate the data model.
Excellent.
And of course, on top of this, you can build general purpose interfaces. Like, for example, this is early work, but this is a set of ASP.NET controls that I'm going to use to hit the same store. And what this does is, all you tell this grid object is, you're going to work with, and you give it a URI. Nice. And the grid does everything for you. Like, for example, I'm going to go to products, and these are all of the products in the database, and I can sort on the different products. I can go here and see that products are related to a category and to a supplier. So I can click this category. This category is seafood, and I can see that this is related to products. So these are the products for the category seafood.
Nice.
And all of this UI is entirely being driven by the information that is being exchanged with the data service. There is no configuration at all in the UI. You can even go here and see the details and make changes. This is fully read-write. Mm-hmm. And all of this does is it will do an HTTP put back to a server to perform the update on the server. So it's nice. A very, very high-level way of doing this.
So let me ask you this, because this is obviously a necessary question.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with the world of HTTP in the cloud, you're talking about scale.
Yes, yes.
So when you think about, you know, MySpace, for an example, they have nothing to do with this project, but let's use them as an example because they have millions of transactions.
Yes, yes.
You know, be questionable whether or not this would scale.
Absolutely. And so you probably picked the biggest problem you could find. But, so in general, so the way we handle scalability is I guess it's the same way we handle the rest of the web-related aspects, which is we try to very, very naturally integrate it to the web. So there is, for example, between interactions with the data servers, there is no state maintained whatsoever on the server. So the system itself is entirely stateless. So this makes it natural to scale this up by just adding web servers. And that's actually how we're hosting in the IMS Live Labs is the systems are completely stateless. We have like round robin without sticky sessions or anything on the server side. And you hit whatever server you hit, and the answers are consistent because there is no chained actions with the previous states at any point.
Excellent.
So you get, of course, you get point-in-time consistency. You get that transaction only. But for the web, this has, you can see because of all of the web out there that this works very well.
Absolutely.
So we're just sort of capitalizing on that model, and we're saying, yeah, we do the same thing. We stay on a very stateless model, and so. We like there are some performance aspects which we try, of course, to go as fast as we can on a single box.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing we focus the most is to make sure that you can trivially scale out to multiple computers and to get more perf back.
But of course, you'll have you'll have the data servers.
Yes.
No, that's where the SQL is going to live. Well, how about synchronization? So when I do an update and I hit one of your websites, how's it? And let's say there's three. Basically, so what's going to happen is you'll just sync with the SQL cluster.
Yeah.
Like so it normally happens today.
There are a couple of strategies. For sort of small to medium sites, typically what you do is you have several web servers which are going to support the data service, and then you have one database server, which may be clustered or not, but it feels like one database server. In that case, the server has to take the entire load. Although you can offload quite a bit by using HTTP caching. So it already eases up the load a little bit. As you go into the higher end sites, typically what those sites do is they heavily rely on partitioning, on horizontal partitioning of data.
Mm.
And you can still do that by saying all of the web servers are going to take the hits, like the web hits. But based on the nature of the data, maybe the key or which part of the database you're hitting, you route to a particular database server that actually has that part of that partition of the database.
Interesting.
This is a very common pattern on sort of high-end websites.
Mm.
And it scales very well because the databases are unrelated to each other. You still use synchronization within the cluster to have redundancy inside a given partition.
Mm.
But the scale out comes from partitioning more than from synchronization.
Absolutely. And it's not really a problem that you guys are... You're in the front end.
We are in the front end, but we are also in the database team. Sure. I can't help
so you can relate to that.
Yeah.
No, my point is, it's not really a problem that Astoria aims to solve.
Absolutely, yeah, that's right. We are very, very focused
on it. But it does bring up an interesting question, in the sense that if I want to use Astoria against a complicated...
topology of databases.
Yeah,
or something. Yeah.
That might have this horizontal partitioning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you guys actually generate the correct?
So we can. You have a couple of options there. Like in the for simple cases, you can actually leverage our mapping infrastructure and do some of that.
Cool.
And it's actually once you go through the complexities of the mapping, the rest of the system almost doesn't see the complexity that comes from it. Once you go past a certain level, you have to do quite a bit of work manually.
Sure.
To do sort of data-dependent routing and stuff like that. But those scenarios are high-end enough that those we focus on just enable them, not
sure.
Making them super easy.
Well, this is a general solution that is actually pretty brilliant. And this is going to be available sometime around Mix.
Yep. Yep.
This video is coming out then. I mean,
yeah,
we're only a few days before Mix, everybody, so this is pretty close to reality. Mm-hmm. And it's a general purpose solution.
Yep.
Not a, super giant, scalable one.
Yeah.
We're
not shooting, scalability typically is a question about database, storage.
Yeah.
And, we're shooting for the programming model. That's our focus right now.
Good.
And, storage in your own site, typically your own database will hold the load just fine. If it holds it today with regular pages, it will hold it with the data service. The story for super high-end stores in the cloud is something that needs more work, and we'll see where you
that's
know.
That's cool. But it's good that you guys
goes.
Are thinking about it, because some good solution will come out of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, hey, thank you, Pablo, for your
no
time.
Problem. Thanks for coming by and talk to us. And
absolutely. This is great stuff, man.
Thanks.
We'll see you down at Mix.
See you at Mix.